is not how I want to spend my holidays! Oh! Let's start the show!
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 231 for the week of December 17th, 2018. I am Lump of David T. Cole, and I'm here with Low Elf Esteem, Sarah D. Bunting.
I think this is a hostile work environment.
Bell Slayer, Tara Ariano.
Putting the dong in Ding Dong.
And True Christmas Queen, Kevin O'Keefe.
Screw everyone winning. I'm the only one.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Before we get into the meat of the episode, a very small piece of site business, and that is it. We are off next week for Christmas. We'll be back the week after with an all FMK episode. Tara.
Joining us this week to talk about some recent holiday specials is Kevin P. O'Keefe. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, hi, Kevin. Tara. Hi, yay! Sarah. Hi, David.
So we're here to talk about the RuPaul's Drag Race Holisley Spectacular and the Nailed It holiday season. And I feel that we should start with Drag Race because Kevin let us know before we started recording he had some things to yell about it. So I'm going to turn it over to Kevin. I don't have a lot of problems with this. I mean, I thought it was sort of corny and silly, but I was like, it's a holiday special. Like, I don't necessarily expect it to meet the high standards of a regular Drag Race episode. But it sounds like you did not have that experience. Go ahead.
Well, it's the single worst episode of Drag Race that's ever aired.
Wow.
So here's the thing. I would not have minded if they had branded this, they had marketed this as like a non-competitive special, right?
Okay,
you know,
sure.
they sell it as like, okay, it's going to be a musical review with all of these new songs being lip synced to or sang to. You know, that's cute. That's fine. That's whatever. It wasn't marketed that way. It was marketed specifically as a competition to find RuPaul's Christmas Queen. And they didn't do that. They didn't do the one thing they said they were going to do. It all ends on this faux cheery everyone wins moment. And then we have to watch stunt doubles of RuPaul and Michelle Visage work. I was very upset.
Well, and then a winner wasn't declared in that either. Like, if that's what you're going to do, force the other queens to pick a winner between Ru and Michelle.
Right. There was nothing competitive about it. And I don't understand what the goal was in selling it as competitive, especially when like you've got All Stars 4 coming up, right? Like you've got something that people are legitimately very excited to see. Starting it on this note just feels so like, I don't know. I guess if anything, it set my expectations super low so that I was really excited about All Stars 4. So I guess that was a positive, but boy, it was not the tea for me.
I mean, given that it's a holiday special, I mean, my initial problem, and I wrote it down, was that it's a holiday special and it's not the 12 Queens of Christmas. Come on now.
Yeah.
That seemed like an obvious missed opportunity. But also, like, the casting was, it seemed very strange. Like, it's clearly not an all-star lineup of queens. Like, there's Trixie Mattel, there's Latrice Royale, and the rest. I mean, granted, Jasmine Masters is in All Stars 4, but I think no one else that was on this episode is, right? Oh, Latrice.
Here's the thing. I wish they would have gone with either load it with All Stars, right? Like get Alaska, get Tatiana, get that caliber, get Alyssa Edwards, or bring back a bunch of queens that we haven't seen in a while. Like I loved seeing Sonique. Like she was to me the delight of the episode because here's this woman who we haven't seen in almost a decade. She's she's stunning. She's beautiful.
Yes.
And has completed a fairly major life journey since we last saw her.
Which is not, they don't get into it at all, really.
No, she has a talking head where she's just sort of like, I've changed a lot. And then that's it. I was certainly thrilled to see her. I was thrilled to see somebody like Mayhem, who I think kind of got a raw deal on season 10, come back. And I thought her Krampus runway look was jaw dropping.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, either give us people who we're really excited to see because we haven't seen them in a while or we didn't really get to see enough of them, or give us, you know, legit marquee stars across the board. This was a weird mix that didn't really work either way.
Yeah. Dave, your thoughts as a huge Drag Race fan?
I really enjoyed the Krampus thing, too. I felt that that was Hollywood level costuming.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
In a show. I mean, it wasn't necessarily strike me as a particularly drag queen outfit, mm-hmm. but it was really amazing. Like, it even had hooves and everything.
Yeah, it was stunning.
Did not even the Christmas theme music do it for you, Kevin? It was like end-to-end disappointment, or did you enjoy the Merry Christmas ho-ho-ho version of the RuPaul theme?
I will admit there were... the theme song, oh my god, I almost threw something at the TV when that came on. my friend even tried to warn me about... My friend had gotten a screener, and he even tried to warn me. He was like, there's going to be a lot that will upset you this episode, and I just... Even being cushioned, I was not ready for a lot of it. I admit that some of the songs were bops. Like, there were a couple songs that stuck in my head the day or two after. But, I mean, RuPaul does produce some good music. Like, I know that it kind of falls into this category of, like, drag music, quote-unquote. So mm-hmm. it's never going to get the same respect as, like, major pop. But, like... There are a lot of songs that RuPaul has produced, especially in this era, like in the RuPaul's Drag Race era, that I think are really good. I think Sissy That Walk is a great song. I think Born Naked is a great song. So I'm not surprised that there were some good songs in there. But I mean, effectively, this was just like a giant commercial for those songs. So yeah. Even in that capacity, it was hard to get excited because, you know, I felt compelled to go buy it on iTunes the whole time.
Yeah. Well, I was more satisfied by the Rue Michelle lip sync, even though it was clearly body doubles doing the twerking. And, you know, I still thought it was fun that they did it. And seeing the two of them on stage side by side is always funny because RuPaul is gigantic and Michelle Visage is like shorter than her personality would make you believe. But yeah, ultimately, I have to agree. This was like sort of a waste of time. It was like I feel like American TV producers have not quite nailed what it takes to make a good holiday special the way the British have been doing it for, you know, decades now. And I appreciate that they keep trying because someone's going to crack it. But yeah, this wasn't it for me either.
Yeah. I mean, I liked parts of it. I'm never bothered by the tendency of some episodes, even in the main, on the main stage of the RuPaul franchise to turn into ads for
Spawn. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they're pretty open about that. And they're also winking at it. And I feel like shade is being directed at Tyra Banks with it, which I'm generally here for as a cultural rule.
That's a great point.
And I do like, I mean, especially when RuPaul is collaborating with Todrick Hall, I think the results are always, bangers. So I didn't have a problem with that. And I will say that the fact that this was not sprawling over an hour and a half or 2 hours is good, not because it was so bad, but because it was like, all right, here are the things that we do with a Christmas spin and then we're out. And Kimchi, with the, just like with a cheat sheet of the lyrics, just flagrantly just holding it up and squinting at it. I just thought it was really good. Mm-hmm. So there were things to like about it, but there was also a lot of times when I was not paying attention. Like there were a couple of caroling montages that I was like, wow, are you that short? This is so slow.
Yeah.
So.
And Eureka could not even be arsed to like do a good job of that. And they were Christmas carols. Like these are songs every person in Western culture, like just knows whether they want to or not.
I'm shocked Eureka came back, honestly, because like her reception after season 10 has been disastrous.
Yeah.
But I definitely think, going back to the casting issues, I definitely think this became sort of like who's available on a Friday in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Totally.
Because I do think almost all of them are LA-based queens. So, yeah. I mean.
So, you know, I'm not the one to give this advice, but I'm going to give it anyways. Because it dovetails into another one of my Dave life rules. Get with me to the end. Much like when you buy a dog, Dave's life rule is you have to get a dog where you can definitely see its eyes all the time, or you don't have a dog. You can't tell what the dog is thinking or feeling. I feel the same way about Trixie Mattel's makeup in this episode. If I cannot see your eyes, I cannot tell what you are doing in the show at the moment, if you're actually throwing shade, if you're actually enjoying the moment.
Yeah, that I used to feel the same way that you do about that makeup, but actually the Trixie and Katya show like acclimated me to it much more. Right. But anyway, continue your dog to four.
No, I'm just saying it's the same thing. If I can't see your eyes, I have trouble empathizing with what you're doing. That's all.
Yeah, the kimchi comparison comes from they actually started doing drag together. So their styles are they like Kimchi was more known for it, but their styles kind of came up at the same time. They were definitely built on each other's. It's not my favorite style, I'll admit, but also Trixie is more famous than any of us will ever be, so I guess, you know, I won't knock it.
I can see how that makeup would work in a small like cabaret space where you have spotlights right on you, and that makeup would be lit up really well, but it wasn't lit up really well on the TV show. It's a different sort of lighting, you know, it's sort of it's an omni light rather than a spotlight, so it really is just like this dark void where their eyes should be. And all right, I'm ending my discussion on this now.
All right, well, let's end our discussion on this and move on to what I imagine we all probably enjoyed a lot more, which was Nailed It Holiday. And Kevin, we wanted you to come on this week because I know this is one of your very favorite shows. And so let's start with the big reveal that also shocked Nicole. Wes got a haircut. Excuse me. Wes got a haircut.
Wes! I love the universe of Nailed It so much. Like, I love that they have, like, out of basically what I thought was a legitimate mistake in season one where the trophy wasn't there one time and she was legitimately calling for Wes because they needed the trophy. And now, like, that's a running gag. Yep. That's part of the universe. They're so great at taking these, like, ramshackle elements and building them into this beautiful character universe. I mean, the haircut was such a great, because I think she legitimately was surprised by it. Like, I don't think she had seen him yet.
It's possible. Yeah.
And she was horrified. She was taken aback.
So this is a 6-episode season plus a bonus craft episode, which I don't know if we need to get into it. It was not my thing, but holiday themed episodes, but otherwise it was like exactly the Nailed It that we know and love. And I thought it was great. It was great to see Sylvia Weinstock come back in episode 3
and go shopping again. Like, well, had you left anything in the kitchen pantry the last time?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, this is looks nice. I love her.
Yeah. Dave had a thought on her, which I thought was he nailed it, as it were, with it. Go ahead. Yeah.
I you'll have to remind me because that was a few days
ago. Oh, that Sylvia Weinstock is in actuality the person that people think Betty White is, but isn't in terms of like adorable senior goofball, you know, wisecracker.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
I stand by the thing I said. Yeah. Hey, speaking about things that I don't stand by, though. Okay, Netflix is a child of the internet. Why is Nailed It Holidays listed separately from Nailed It the Show? This is obviously season 3 of the same show.
They do this with Great British Bake Off as well, with the older seasons, and they're like, Great British Bake Off beginnings. Like, fuck off. Just put it in the same spot.
Well, they did it with Narcos, too. Like, arguably Narcos Mexico is a different show than Narcos, but is it really? I would say no.
It's not. No. It's a continuation. Like, I don't mind if you brand a season. That's fine. Yeah. Just make it season 3 of 4 of Narcos is the Mexico season. Like, don't create a new show ID in your database just because you want to brand a particular chunk of that show's existence. It is so annoying. And then that sort of spins out, because then when you get people that actually want to curate their database, you know, that write stories on websites and want them to have the same show ID because they're the same show, then you get into a case where Netflix says this and TVDB says this and blah, 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 blah. And they're all different. And then you just don't know what to, you know, what to do. Anyways, and Netflix, this is season 3. They should have put season 3. I am not a crackpot. Boo, Netflix.
Definitely not. And I would also point everybody to a recent episode of Appointment Television co-hosted by recent guest Catherine Van Arendonk, because they talk about how the many failings of the various streaming systems that services that we all use and tolerate, even though they have these dumb idiosyncrasies. So back to the show. I mean, what is there to say? It was great. There was something to love in every episode, something to be bothered by. I have in my notes armpit alert with Brian, the triathlete who came out in his like singlet with his armpits fully hanging out in episode two. Not acceptable. It's a kitchen. Like, people are making food. Put those away.
MVP to Brian's boyfriend, who in the introduction to Brian section was like, Brian's like, I made this. And his boyfriend's like, I don't want to eat that. And they stink face. And I was like, yeah, that's our house.
So I actually have met Brian multiple times before. I did not realize this. I know. I had not realized this until my ex texted me and said, we know Brian. And apparently he was at a bunch of parties that we went to in like 2015, 2016. So after remembering him, I'm sort of like, oh yeah, you know, it makes sense that he's on Nailed It. But yeah, he was an interesting character, right? Because I have obviously a very heavily gay timeline on Twitter. Sure. And there was about a halfway split between people who were annoyed by the athleisure wear, who were annoyed by the no sleeves, et cetera, and another half who were just sort of fixated on his cake, so to speak. So I guess, you know, if he's talked about, that's important.
Right.
But yeah, he apparently, they list him as director of communications. He's actually the director of communications for the Clinton Foundation. Oh. So like, there's a whole extra bit there, you know?
Wow. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's a lot. He's a lot. He's probably of the new characters, the one that I've heard the most talk about. I was thrown off a little bit by the woman who had a very emotional experience on Nailed It on the toys episode.
Alicia.
I believe her name, I can't remember exactly what her name was, but she had the short haircut. Nicole complimented her haircut.
Alicia was her name.
Yeah, thank you.
And she's going to be listening because I tweeted about the show just in general. So be careful because she's going to be checking it out.
Yeah, I 100% appreciate the emotion. I think not necessarily on her behalf, but the way it was edited or the way it was handled was kind of odd.
Yes.
Because we don't usually get like a major serious moment like that on Nailed It. And Nicole, who I adore, who I want to win the best reality host Emmy at the Emmys next year, who I think is just wonderful, seems sort of ill-equipped to handle it. And I almost wonder why they thought it was important they left it in, but I would have been fine without it if that was just her private emotional journey. You know, it didn't really seem to fit with the show itself.
Yeah, I think they established that she had a head injury, and so she'd been like on a recovery path for a while, and I thought it was sort of nice that what she was saying about her experience on the show was like that it underscored what is actually great about the show. And what, you know, when people ask me like, oh, it seems so mean-spirited, like when we talked about it on the show the last time on the podcast, that people were asking, is it okay to watch with my kids, it seems so mean. And I was sort of trying to explain like everyone is in on it, like everyone, all of the contestants know, like, they're there to fail and like they get like it. But at the same time, like
in episode two, they love definitely that. Know like that. Yeah. I thought that was great, especially since that woman's whole intro, Tanya, was about how she is socially anxious and basically afraid of people. But she still has this dream of like the hallway scene at the end of Lucas. And then that happens for her. And even though it's a total setup, it's like, I don't think it's mean at all, especially since Jacques is like the happiest man in baking shows.
Yep.
And his pronunciation of shalom is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy. I can't even do it, but he was like, shalom, bakers. And he was so proud of himself. I mean, I actually didn't watch the whole season because I am hoarding it for when my family comes over on Christmas so that we could just all laugh together at some of these dreidels. Yeah.
I think if you're talking to somebody and they're unsure whether the show, you know, is genuinely mean-spirited or everybody is in on the setting up to fail aspect of it, excuse me, you can just say, like, they're never given enough oven space to bake all the cake they need to actually reproduce what they're supposed to be doing. Shown. Like, the Hanukkah cake that was 4 stories tall, and they can only fit a maximum of, like, 4 pans in the correct oven that they're baking in. And that would make a third of the height of that cake, given that they only get like 90 minutes, 2 hours. They only have one baking period. So just knowing that, like, the goal isn't to actually reproduce it. The goal is to come as close as you can under these very restrictive elements.
No, and the point that I was trying to get to with Alicia is that, like, what she was saying is that, like, the effort is rewarded. The effort is what counts.
Totally.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, I was just going to say, talking about other big contestants, the slow clap woman, Tanya, I adored. I loved when she used the freezer burn to screw Brian because his cakes needed to come out of the oven. And then she got that confessional where she was just like, do I regret using the freezer burn? No.
Yes, it's really good.
I think if you have a freezer burn or any other time freeze thing, that it's not actually the baking part of it that you want to do it. It's the whipping part. You know, when you have something where if you whip it too much, it becomes too thick. The air is whipped out of it too much. And then that sort of just screws you. I like to win. I think about these things.
Yeah, one of the things that I said was that I wished there we got one episode where Jacques was trying to make the thing alongside them, because I you know, as Dave said, like, they definitely don't get enough space, and they certainly don't get enough time to do all the things that they're supposed to. And I think part of the, you know, the meta joke of the show is that, like, the model cakes are ridiculous also. Like, why is anyone making this cake? Never mind, why would anyone try to reproduce it, you know?
Right.
Well, Nicole points that out at some point, that Jacques, like, that they're like, oh, well, what should bakers look out for in this process? I think it was the Hanukkah cake. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, first you want to do this, and then, and finally Nicole just, like, looks at the camera and it's like, sure, no problem. Only 17 steps there. What could possibly go wrong? And I think everybody knows right up top, like, what makes the show is the contrast between these beautiful professional things that they're trying to imitate, and then what is revealed, especially since they're like, at a certain point, they all just give up.
Yep.
And are like, okay. And like, well, this is my interpretation. Like, it's a bunny slope. And then they're just jamming rock candy into it, and they don't care. And they're just about to start crying. It's so good.
Yeah.
Though I feel in this season, there's been an emergence of what video gamers call a new meta. So when, like, a new patch, a balancing patch or something like that, new weapons are introduced, it changes what they call the meta, which is how you have to play the game to win, or how you have to attack the game in the early parts of it. I feel like this season, people are discovering that, yeah, obviously they can't really reproduce it. I feel like I heard a lot of, like, well, I'm just going to do one of everything. Like, I'm just going to make sure I have each element in, even if each element isn't great.
That happened a lot on the DIY episode. Yeah.
The guy who eventually won it was like, oh, well, I can't really do the elf really to that fidelity, and I can't do the tree perfectly and the gloves, but he got all the elements in and he won.
Yeah.
The judges basically said that. And there's another one earlier. Their design wasn't the best, but they had an okay design with a cake that tasted okay, rather than a great design with a shit cake.
Yeah.
So I feel like people are kind of glomming on to that, which I don't know if that's going to improve the show or sort of reduce the parts of it that are great because of naivete of everybody that's on it. It's sort of like American Idol, you know, when people started realizing that they get more press from being the William Hung guy than, you know, than being the star.
Mm-hmm. Although I'll say this, they had an All-Stars episode this season and none of those people could do a damn thing. So clearly people aren't learning. I do want to talk about the DIY episode just, like, really briefly while we're sort of on it. Mm-hmm. I think it's bad, but I think that I think that doing sort of a making it style nailed it could work. It's that the guy that they got to replace Jacques was not much of anything.
He was really boring.
And if we're talking about, like, what makes the Sarah, earlier you mentioned that, like, what makes the show is the disparity between the cake they're supposed to make and what they actually make, which is right. But I also think what makes the show is just Nicole and Jacques. I think they are.
Sure.
I think they are Heidi and Tim. I think they are Padma and Calicchio. Like, I think they've struck on, and Magical Elves is the production company, and they produced Early Project Runway and all of Top Chef. They are really good at finding an expert who maybe shouldn't be as fun as they are, but livens up quickly with somebody who's so out of their element here but is really good at the hosting gig, and then like having them play off each other. It's a really incredible dynamic, and they're, I mean, they're one of my favorite comedy duos on television. I love them.
Yeah, it's amazing how Jacques even seems like he's surprised by how much he loves to do it. Like, yes. he really is, you can tell, legitimately tickled by Nicole. Like, he just thinks she's the best, and she obviously like treasures him too. They are an amazing team. You're so right.
I think, like, though, this season's going to...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go, because I'm doing another classic Dave change of
topic. Pronouncement.
Okay. I was just going to say that literally every time she pulls a snack out of the muff, he's surprised and laughs at it. Every time. It's amazing. It's like this Pavlovian thing that he's like, oh, it's a Twizzler. And then sometimes it's because it's such an American snack, I think, mm-hmm. that he's laughing. And then he always eats it. Like, this is somebody who really, you know, if he were on Top Chef or Top Chef Just Desserts or whatever, they would really be blowing a lot of gold up his culo about like Master Chocolatier. Mm-hmm. But he's like, it's just chocolate. Like, he doesn't take himself that seriously. Yeah. Like, he is a Master Chocolatier, but he's also like, it's not brain surgery. Like, I'm just going to eat this licorice and have a good time and get my check and take selfies. And I really love the joy that he brings to it, that he's like, if I were him, I'd be sitting there like, this is my life. Like, I get paid to do this. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I used to work around the corner from the flagship Jacques Torres store in New York when I was at Sling, Sarah, down on Varick Street. He would be in that store all the time. And so would I, obviously, because I would see him cough. Like, they had really good cookies. What? And he was like, just so, even then, this was way before Nailed It. Like, he was so friendly. He would be out on the floor, like chatting with people and selling them stuff. Like, he is that guy. And he was delightful. Dave, pronouncement time.
This dovetails. I just want to say, as good as those two hosts are together, you have the multiplier of when they actually get a good judge, and there's been some not good judges this season. The Irish lady,
she was boring,
didn't really fit in, didn't really comedically, didn't really know what to do. She sort of like put the brakes on the flow of everything every like once every 5 minutes, whereas contrast that with Jason Mantzoukas episode, which was amazing. And like kind of brought the A game to an A plus game. The unicorn is somebody who is very knowledgeable in baking, also being very funny. But I think if you're going to go one way or the other, I think you usually got to go somebody who's funny that doesn't know a lick about baking, rather than getting the YouTube expert or, you know, the blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ron Funches was good, too. I think comedians definitely are better. And when he was eating that guy's cookie, he was like, how is it dry and wet? Like, his delivery on it was so flummoxed. He was amazing.
Yeah. But like, Cupcake Wars guy was also really good, because like he had the magic and stuff. And like, that was delighting Nicole and Jacques. And yeah, I think that he's sort of that unicorn that we're talking about. But I loved Ron. That entire presentation of the dry and wet cookie with Nicole's faces. I mean, it's truly, I had already done my best TV moments of the year list, but honestly, that could have been on there. Like, it was, God, I just love this show. And I thought this was the best season yet, honestly. Like, I think
I agree overall.
I think that it's drastically improving every time. And I'm just so, so happy about it.
I mean, ironically, it's because it's impossible to fuck it up. The formula is so good there, and I laugh at it more than I laugh at any sitcom, and I watch a lot that I think are very funny. Like, it's so pure. And I have to give a shout out to recent guest Kim Reed, because she said about that episode with the helicopter reveal that her son laughed so loud and so long and so hard she thought he was going to throw up. So if that's not an endorsement of the show, I do not know what is.
Best show.
It's time for Around the Dial, our first stop, Tara Ariano.
Well, RuPaul's Drag Race and Nailed It were not the only shows that were doing special holiday episodes, because I'm here to talk about Dr. Pimple Popper, the 12 Pops of Christmas. Oh. Guys, I could make this up. Oh. I didn't. It was real. So this show, I've talked about it before. It's the show with Dr. Sandra Lee, who's got famous on YouTube popping various skin issues that people have. And the premise is that there's always an end of the year rush because, she says, people want to look good before they see their family and friends, whereas I think it's probably because they want to make up their deductibles before the year rolls over. Health insurance, cough. But the premise is that it's a day with 12 pops, and obviously it's contrived because there's a lot of bumper stuff, and Dr. Lee and her nurses are obviously very skilled, but they are not skilled at acting. And so they try to force on the holiday gimmick. Like, the first woman comes in with keloids on her earlobes, which, look it up. I won't get into it because whatever. But Dr. Lee tries to make it cute by calling them ornaments, which this woman has had these giant, like, rather large, ear growths for 20 years. She says, like, I don't think she thinks it's cute. Another guy comes in with two lipomas on his arm, and she's like, it looks like a snowman. Like, stop. Also, this thing is 90 minutes long, which I am pro pop, but that's too long. Like, this is too many. And they don't build. Like, there's no rhythm to the episode. Like, it just is sort of like there's a few kind of showstoppers up top, and then it's just like, okay, now this person has skin tags. Like, I'm glad they're happy, but this is boring for me as a viewer. However, we do get the information that Dr. Lee's husband is also a dermatologist, and apparently not famous, because he is very grouchy about being on camera. According to as far as the show portrays it, they work together in this practice. And she, like, does this thing where she sneaks mistletoe into a cupboard, and he, like, is really grouchy about being on camera with her and, like, kissing her and stuff. He only kisses her on the lips. So, like, keep an eye on the Lee marriage, because I feel like this is a guy who might not be thrilled about his wife outshining him. And just in terms of the health insurance aspect, I will also say one of the patients was Canadian. She journeyed to California from London, Ontario. So, I mean, I guess Canadian health insurance can't do everything, or she didn't try. But she had a thing that is called a dilated pore of Weiner, spelled W-I-N-E-R. So nothing to do with Matthew Weiner, as far as I know. But it was like an enormous blackhead that she had in her cheek for, like, right by her ear for, she said, 55 years. When they took it out, it was hard. Like, they knocked it on the table. What we could see was the diameter of a pea, but what they pulled out was a lot larger, and I am changed. There was also stuff underneath it. So if you're a Dr. Pimple Popper fan, it's worth seeing for this was pop number 5. Because holy shit, it was amazing. But, you know, this, I grant that the show is not for everyone, and as an episode, it was poorly made, but still, the show brings the pops, and they showed a super tease at the end for the season 2, which starts January 3rd, and I will be front row. And I sense from your silence and horror, I am the only one.
I looked up for like 2 seconds, and I saw something with look like a snake of mechanics grease coming out of somebody's neck or something. I'm like, yeah. Nope. Out. Dark gray. Like, how does something dark gray grow inside of you?
Yeah, it's really bad. And also, like, there's times where the editors, they show the patients, like, on the chair writhing. And I always just think, like, knock them out. It never seems like she gives them enough anesthesia. It certainly would not be enough for me. God forbid I ever have any of these things wrong with me. Please, God, don't let my mean comments about the show visit these punishments on me. For my plug, I will mention, I said it last week, Slate's TV Club is now running. So go to slate.com. It's everywhere. But also next week, I'm sure you are all already listening to our former co-host Joe Reed's podcast, This Had Oscar Buzz. I am thrilled to say I'm going to be on their Christmas Day episode talking about one of my favorite movies, The Family Stone. So make sure you check that out. It drops on Christmas Day. It was a wonderful experience. So I hope everyone likes it. It was great.
All right, Kevin, your turn.
So my favorite show that I love to hate, Hulu's Marvel's Runaways, which for briefly was Freeform's Hulu's Marvel's Runaways. It comes back for season 2 on this Friday, December 21st. It will be airing week by week, unlike Netflix. Hulu chooses to do its shows pretty much week by week. Occasionally they'll drop a few at a time. Hulu's Marvel's Runaways is a adaptation of a very famous comic arc in Marvel called The Runaways. As you could probably imply or infer from the title, it is about teens who run away, superpowered teens who run away. Season one of Hulu's Marvel's Runaways did not feature the Runaways running away. And they did not do that until the last episode of season one of Hulu's Marvel's Runaways. Season two of Hulu's Marvel's Runaways, they have actually run away. So honestly, at the start, we've already improved. We're already a step up. Unfortunately,
I think this is known as the preacher effect in TV comic adaptations.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most of the rest of this show has not really improved. I've seen the first five episodes. I will admit to enjoying it more than hating it this time. Like the ratio has probably shifted from like 70-30 to like 65-35. So we're moving up. But ultimately you've got a lot of pretty sad sack characters in this. There's I think six teens, and I think two of them are kind of worth their salt. I enjoy weird glowy girl, whose name I believe is Katarina, but I refer to exclusively as weird glowy girl.
Yeah.
Sure. I really like Witch with a Stick, who I also believe's name, it's not Alex, actually. I can't remember what her name is. Alex is the boy who's really boring. The fact that I cannot remember these characters' names, despite having watched this, 15 episodes of the show, is pretty much all the indictment of the show that you need. They're more recognizable by their powers or lack thereof. One guy's just rich and has gloves that shoot out into things.
Is it always next to a Nintendo Entertainment System? So, I think I know what he's doing.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a lot of, I don't know, non-powers or super extraordinary powers. There's kind of no in between. But the biggest flaw on the show's part and why I really dislike it is, so the whole point is these kids find out that their parents are part of a secret villainous organization called Pride, which is a gay man I feel slightly offended by. But they basically fight their parents. But I think the showrunners know that watching a bunch of kids fight their parents constantly would be really upsetting to watch. So they don't do that. And instead, it's God, I don't even really know how to describe it. It's like a chess match that never actually goes anywhere. Like, we see the kids moving around. We see the parents moving around. We spend a lot of time with the parents, which is unfortunate because they're far less compelling as characters.
I think this can be described as the Two Towers effect.
Yes. Yeah. Essentially, it's like, imagine watching a chess match, but instead of them actually going at each other, all the pieces just kind of move around each side of the board. And that's basically it. But I will say, if you enjoyed season one at all, and you want to continue on with the journey, this is not worse. It's fine. But I think you were mentioning TV Club, Tara. Willa Paskin started off TV Club with a treatise on fine TV, which I highly recommend, and I think is very relevant to this discussion, because Runaways is fine TV, right? Like, it's well made. It's certainly quote unquote prestigious. It's just not very good. Like, there's not really a ton to recommend it. But I'll probably keep watching because I feel kind of invested in this journey at this point. So I'm probably locked in. Yeah. Yeah.
And what do you got to plug there?
Yeah. Okay. So I just wrapped up this past Sunday an episode of the season finale episode of my web series, The Kiki. The Kiki is a Drag Race dissection and dissemination series, to quote Willem in Alaska. It's with my friend and co-host, Matthew Rodriguez. We both cover Drag Race as part of our jobs. And so they asked us if we wanted to launch they asked us if we'd like to launch a YouTube series. And it was kind of a fun success that we were not expecting and drew a pretty great audience. We've covered everything from the way show edits villains to why the wig reveal or taking your wig off in a lip sync has changed so much since the start of the show. We've covered what makes All-Star seasons either good or bad, the best impressions on Snatch Game, the best runway looks. It's been a lot of fun. There's 12 episodes. You can find them all at youtube.com/intomore. Highly recommend binging them. We're done with season one for now. And we're also now on all social media at Join the Kiki. So that's Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Join the Kiki. Because we want you to join the Kiki. So that's Woo. My plug.
We'll link it in the show notes.
Thank you.
Sarah D. Bunting.
So on a recent trip to visit my work spouses in Austin, Texas, I was introduced to a program called Teen Mom, Young and Pregnant, which I keep calling Teen Mom, Young and Stupid. I mean, same basic premise. So I get sucked into this and put it on my season pass list on my DVR and come to find out that Tara is not even keeping up with it right now. So I have no one to help me on this segment. But it's sort of like it's very depressing the way that 90% of the children's names are spelled is extremely aggravating. To me, K-L-O-I-E is not a thing. It's Ooh. Not a thing. Although, nope. actually, the standard spelling of Chloe is sort of annoying. So, like, you know, no offense, Chloe's, but that can be a tough one. But there ends up being this, I think, almost inadvertent. Like, I don't think the show is necessarily trying to make any larger meta statements about society, but it ends up doing that. There's mm-hmm. this, like, it's a commentary on the various underclasses created by capitalism.
Yep.
The divide that is growing between haves and have-nots.
Well, the sub story of all of these is like, if they had other options, they might not have had kids, but we join them after this decision has been made or taken out of their hands for whatever reason.
Yeah, possibly by their geographic location. Mm-hmm. It's a comment on healthcare and on, you know, living in a like hypocritically conservative country or state, depending on where they are, on the haves and have-nots problems in education and healthcare in this country, on the opioid crisis, sort of mm-hmm. gutting half a generation, particularly in a family where there are kind of generations clustered closer together than might be ideal, let's say. I think some families make it work, but others, it's just like, the grandma or great grandma is still on duty after like 55 years of doing this because kind of everyone between her and the baby was prescribed Vicodin at some point and game over.
Yep.
Go to hell, Sacklers, and burn there.
yeah, it's really dark. I'll say this, though.
It's very dark.
What's interesting about Teen Mom Young and Pregnant is it's basically Teen Mom 4. So it's the same as all of the other shows, although some of them are not, strictly speaking, teens. But it shows them at the beginning of this cycle because their struggles are very different than what you now see on Teen Mom and Teen Mom 2, because those ones have been on the show long enough that now they are rich. Like, they get paid a lot to do the show. And yeah. So they're like, we're shopping for a bigger house. Like, you know, it's like Macy and her now husband, not the father of her first child that got her on the show in the first place, you know, buying this like 8-bedroom house because the show has made them so wealthy. So like, I feel like there's, you know, it's interesting to watch these ones because it's like, this is how it starts. And they are just hoping the show doesn't get canceled, because if it does, they'll be super duper fucked.
Well, yeah, I mean, spoiler, in the finale, like, Brianna has already sent the, you know, trifling, they're all trifling, but the trifling mm-hmm. Robert packing.
Yeah.
And then, but like, he was paying a third of their bills, and mm-hmm. then she loses her job because if her mom is working, she can't provide the childcare that Brianna can't afford
right.
to outsource. And they're just very close to living in the car.
Yep.
You see a lot of broken iPhone screens that they just don't have a spare, whatever, $75 to get a new one because mm-hmm. they gotta buy diapers and keep the lights on. And the whole Kayla Stephan situation, like mm-hmm. that guy makes me want to find him and kick him until he cries. He's just terrible. Like, even his own family on camera is like, will you get a grip, please? But he won't, except possibly on Kayla and in a felonious way. And I think that's another area in which the show, without comment, but I think it's important to show these dynamics of abuse and feeling completely powerless if you're the victim to do anything about it, because you, I mean, this is like your child's father, and there are various ways that you're relying on him to just be a human being, because everything's so close to the edge in terms of their financial situation. So yeah, it's
roof.
It's dark. I mean, there's also room for petty judgments. So there's a little bit of petty fun to be had, but mostly it's grim. And now I'm sucked into it. And I do hope that it gets renewed, because otherwise some of these people are going to be on the street, and it's not good. Like, they're babies.
Yeah. Sorry, Sarah. I'm not that sorry.
Yeah. Dick. So anyway, for my plug, speaking of crimes, I have a podcast about crimes and the show's podcasts and books about those crimes. It's called The Blotter Presents. This week, my guest is our esteemed colleague, Allison Lo Huff, who is talking about Netflix's The Innocent Man and also this podcast. The podcast is kind of just okay, but the story it's talking about, namely Lou Pearlman, his Ponzi scheme and his blimp business, it's amazing. There's some clips in there that I think you'll really enjoy. And actually, later in this episode of Extra Hot Great, you'll be getting kind of a sneak preview. We'll get to it, but that's it. The Blotter Presents on iTunes and wherever else you get your podcasts.
Okay, I am not a crackpot. Put a pin in that. Been watching Little Drummer Girl, finally getting around to it, which is the AMC's miniseries. It's good. It's very 70s Day of the Jackal and all that kind of feel. I am enjoying it. I am not a crackpot, but if your TV show is going to have tippy-typey, you know, Chiron for location, West Germany, you have to have a typewriter font. You don't get to have that sound and that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 letter at a time reveal if you don't have a typewriter font. You can't do it with a character recognition computer font from the 70s, because that is in no way associated with one at a time typing or a teletype or a telex or a fax or anything like that. That's something that just appears on the screen or is in printed material and it's just scanned in or whatever. You gotta marry the font with the sound effect and whatever you're going for. I feel like somebody just saw that in, like, you know, something that actually used it correctly, say like the X-Files, where they actually had a typewriter font, tick, 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 go on. And they thought, well, this takes place in the 70s, so let's use the 70s computer font. And it doesn't match up and it drives me crazy. Thoughts? Okay. That's all I have to say. Thank you for listening to me. I am not a crackpot. It's time for our extra credit topic. Tara, what do we have?
Side character spinoff. This comes from Suli, who writes, I really want a Nailed It spinoff with Amanda, the Southern Paula Deen-esque lady from season one, and we now know season Holiday, where she and Jacques Torres go on dates and she generally moons over him and attempts to help him bake. I believe hilarity would ensue. It definitely would. Suli wants to know, what other reality show characters should get their own little spinoffs? Since we were talking about Nailed It this week, I went with a Nailed It one, which is Kelvin from episode one of the holiday season. Kelvin is the barber slash pastor who said in his intro, he would really like to officiate a wedding for which he also makes the cake. And I feel like if he also did the hair for that wedding, like this, he's a one-stop shop for wedding planning and all wedding services that you need. So Kelvin, the barber slash pastor, late addition, but I feel like there's something there. Kevin.
So I went with another cooking show, but it's a different one airing right now. Top Chef. This past episode had a guest appearance from usual regular judge Gail Simmons, who is on maternity leave this season. She is one of my all-time favorites of anything. Reality show judges, people, Gales. I have a lot of gales that I love, as we know from my Star is Born fandom. But yeah, she has always struck me as somebody who should have a cooking show of her own. She is so crazy personable. And they've tried a couple things with her on Bravo. She was the host of both Top Chef Duels and Top Chef Just Desserts, but I don't think hosting like a competition is really the right format for her. I want throw her on the Food Network, give her, you know, a Pioneer Woman-esque show where she just like is delightful the entire time, and I would watch the shit out of it. That's what I want for her.
Excellent. Sarah.
It is really not appropriate, I understand, to call the mother of the victim of a brutal murder a reality show character. Much less to suggest that she get a spinoff, but here we all are. I would listen to Pepe Carter from The Innocent Man narrate just about anything. Here's why. We have a clip, but before we play it, let me say nothing Pepe is about to tell you is good. This is the tip of the iceberg of her grief, and she is admitting to drunk driving repeatedly, and yet she has such an ear for her own story. This really will not be quite the same without the Sophia Petrillo-esque hand gestures and eye rolls, but hopefully you will get the idea. Dave, if you could roll that clip.
Oh, yes. Got to drinking. Ooh. Pills wasn't working. Nothing worked. I got to drinking. I'd get off at midnight, and I'd stop at a convenience store and get me a whole 12-pack. And I'd hit them country roads, roll my windows down, turn that radio up, and I just sang and drank and sang and drank. Throw out them beer cans, get me another one.
Ooh. Yeah, singing and drinking with Pepe Carter, who is my vote for Democratic presidential nominee in 2020. And I know Ms. Alison Lohuff is going to second that motion. Dave.
I started off just trying to do something with this one particular guy from a reality show, and it ended up in an international crossover sort of production. So here we go. Glenn Hetrick from Face Off. If you don't know Face Off, he is this special effects artist who's sort of like an LA. He's got an LA punk look. Probably the guy that hangs around, you know, the tattoo stores from, you know, all the TV shows about tattoo stores. So we're going to take him, and he's like an accomplished makeup and special effects artist, and he has his own studio and all that stuff. And we're going to send him to Iceland to work on that cat colony under a camera show called Keeping Up with the Cat Darsians. Remember this? You know, it's basically the equivalent of that Japanese camera on the puppies. Except this was in Iceland and it's all cats. So what I want to do is take him and his expertise, and he's going to create high production, pop culture infused, you know, habitation areas for these cats. So instead of just romping around on carpeted claw scratchers and poles, you know, they're now on the set of Aliens or whatever, and they get to do all their cute things, except it's all in this sort of like demonic, scary, horror tinged special effects stuff. And once in a while, they dress up a cat as a character. So like Ripley Cat kind of like walks through the set.
Once in a great while. Spoiler.
It is time for the canon. Submitting this week, one Tara Ariana.
Hello. I'm presenting One Day at a Time, Season 1, Episode 13, Keen Says. I have yet to watch this episode without sobbing by the end, so we'll see how this goes. It might be rough. Back in episode 205, our guest Maureen Ryan presented the season 2 finale, Not Yet, and at that time I voted against the submission only because the show is so great that for me there were other episodes that surpassed it, and Keen's is one of them. The episode revolves around the titular event to which the entire season has been building, Elena's quinceañera, which has arrived just in time to coincide with her coming out as gay to her immediate family. Let's talk about what I think makes this episode of a very special show especially remarkable. Number one, it's extremely specific about the stresses of throwing a quinceañera. Rising diversity in TV creators means, among other things, that people outside the majority culture can tell stories about their own communities, and that's definitely what we get with Elena's quinces. Of course, this is a potentially relatable story regardless of what your ethnic background is. Lots of people have put on big parties for family members that aren't as helpful as they could be, gotten so stressed out about it that they haven't been as gracious as they could be to the helpers who actually do come through. Clip one.
First arrivals are in 42 minutes, and Schneider, I'm sorry that I'm in hyper-focused bitch mode, but really,
Thank you so much for doing this.
Penn, are you kidding me? You guys are like family.
TikTok.
But this episode brings those of us who aren't Cuban Americans into the experience with the specificity of its gags, like when Lydia comes along for a final walkthrough of the event space in clip two.
Excuse me. Where is the dance floor?
You're standing on it.
Are you kidding me? I have relatives who escaped from Cuba on a rat bigger than this.
Or when Penelope gets the news that some former no RSVPs are about to fuck up her seating chart in clip three.
Mom, don't freak out.
What happened?
It's going to be fine, but Tia Mimi just got a call, and you know the Fajardos?
Rosita, Diana, Marta, Cristina, Juanito, and baby Juanito? Can't come because of a baptism on Rosita's mother's side?
They're coming.
Oh, come on!
I should have known better. The Fajardos are OG Cubans. They run on Caribbean time. Cristina was pregnant with baby Juanito for 11 months, and she still thinks he was premature.
I trust that these setbacks are Cuban as hell, because I know that's who makes the show. But at the same time, everyone can empathize with the scream Penelope lets out when Dr. Berkowitz accidentally knocks over the seating chart. Some things are universal. By the way, this time through watching the episode was the first time I noticed that all of the tables, which are named after famous feminists, one of them is Eva Perón, which maybe do a little more Googling, Penelope, just saying. Moving on, number two, the B plot about Elena's dress is a winner on multiple levels. Okay, maybe more like half a dozen. Elena started the season not wanting to have a quinceañera at all, in part because of its gender essentialism. But over time and through some learning experiences over the course of the season, she has come around. We hear a little bit of that in clip four.
Eh?
Mom, a tiara is a backward symbol of how women are only valued for their beauty. And now that I'm wearing one, I don't care. I look awesome and it's super sparkly!
We know from watching her for a whole season that Lydia has no such qualms and is going to lean all the way in on dressing Elena for the party. And while Penelope is taking on all the stress over party logistics, Lydia is prepared to throw multiple shit fits about Elena's gown. We hear one of those in clip five.
Thank you so much, Abuelita. It's beautiful.
What's wrong with it?
Nothing. I'm happy. I'm smiling.
Exactly. You are not sobbing with joy. I have failed you. I have failed my family. I have failed Cuba.
In a second pass, Lydia tries changing the neckline and refuses to take Elena's dry-eyed reassurances that she's happy with the design. Lydia's love language is style, and only when her third take on Elena's kinsis look finally elicits her granddaughter's happy tears does she know she nailed it. We don't actually see it when Elena does. It's still in the garment bag while Elena and Penelope peek and weep. But at the party, when Elena's called out to join her court, she's in a white tuxedo with the former bodice of her gown repurposed as a sparkly bustier. Obviously, you listeners at home can't see it, but here's the studio audience reaction, clip six. So I've watched this episode many times. This is pretty much where I start sobbing and don't stop. Lydia has given Elena the outfit Elena might not have even known she wanted, and it's impossible not to be moved seeing her express herself through fashion, thanks to the grandmother who truly accepts and loves her. Number three, it celebrates a character who deserves it. Elena's really been on a journey over the course of this first season, and we've watched her grow up from a predictable, slightly annoying teen pinko through her new knowledge about her sexuality. But Penelope's been on a journey, too, and the quinceañera gives her a chance to tell Elena's loved ones what it's meant to her to go through it with a daughter like Elena. Clip 7.
August 7th, 2001. The doctor said Elena was due August 15th, but you know her. She ain't let no man tell her when she gonna get burned. Elena has always been her own girl, and now she's becoming her own woman. When she was in third grade, she played the cherry tree in a school play. And when George Washington swung his axe, she hit him back and yelled, "Trees are people too!" And that's Elena, always sticking up for the underdog. Whether it's a tree, an animal, a friend, or me.
She's taught me more about being strong, selfless, and true to yourself than I could have ever taught her.
I love this acknowledgement from Penelope that the end of her marriage and the PTSD that has followed her military service have changed her relationship to her daughter and let a room full of people who love them both know how they've been able to lean on each other. Number four, it portrays how a coming out can go badly. When Elena came out to Penelope earlier in the season, the show gave Penelope an imperfect yet honest reaction. While she expressed support for and to Elena, she privately excoriated herself for not being more okay with Elena's announcement, particularly given that Penelope has both served with lesbians and been emotionally intimate with them at her PTSD support group. Penelope, of course, sorts herself out on her own time and shields Elena from her confusion. Alex, Elena's brother, and Lydia are also loving and accepting. Then Victor, Elena's dad, arrives for the quinces, and Elena also comes out to him in clip eight.
I have grown up, and I've learned a lot about myself since you've been gone. And I've changed. Well, not changed, but, I'm gay.
Yeah, and you're pregnant too, right? Let's do all the shockers.
No, Buffy, I'm serious. I came out while you were gone, and I was just waiting for the right time to tell you.
I don't understand. Why are you doing this?
Okay, so this wasn't the right time. Just don't be mad.
No, I'm not mad. You're just confused. I mean, you're 15. You don't know what the hell you're talking about.
What's going on? I told him.
Did you know about this?
Yeah. Just give us a sec.
Are you indulging whatever this is?
Oh, you mean supporting our daughter? Yeah, I am.
No, she's not. She's not that way, okay? I've been gone a year. What the hell's been going on here?
Wow. Okay. Look, I didn't know she was going to tell you, but now that she did, you're going to have to figure out a way to be okay with it.
No, I don't have to be okay with anything. She's mixed up, and you're her mother. You aren't even trying to talk some sense into her?
That's not how this works, Victor.
Oh, so we're all just supposed to pretend like this is cool? Because it's not. Right? It's not.
A lot of times, being well-meaning, TV shows can err on the side of idealistic over realistic. For example, I recall a Degrassi The Next Generation plotline that involved a minister's daughter dating a trans boy and her parents barely objecting before being okay with it. But while society in general may be less homophobic than it used to be, individuals still have ingrained prejudices, and Victor's reaction, while hurtful, doesn't feel outlandish in its scale. Victor continues to be kind of a drama queen about everything, threatening to leave town without attending the quinces. Penelope starts out seeming pretty sure he'll go through the same process of acceptance that she did and urges him to be there for Elena. And Victor does show up for the quinces, but he sours at the reveal of Elena in her tuxedo, and when the time comes for their father-daughter dance, he's gone. Victor's a military contractor from a conservative Catholic community. It's hard on Elena that his response to her news is to abandon her, but based on what we know about him, it doesn't exactly come out of the blue. Instead of giving real-life Elena's a wish-fulfillment fantasy, the episode stays grounded in harsh reality. But, point five, it also proves Elena doesn't need Victor. Elena ends up standing alone on the dance floor, Schneider coming to the doorway of the banquet hall and shaking his head to indicate that Victor's not in the building. The first time I watched this episode, I braced myself for Schneider to take Victor's place with Elena because he's around, he's a man, and maybe to set himself up as Penelope's eventual love interest or whatever. But I should have had more trust in the show because what actually happens is that Penelope wipes her eyes and goes to dance with Elena. Clip nine.
I got you.
Oh, this ovation is a lot less exuberant than the one that greeted Elena's tux reveal, presumably because everyone in the studio audience is crying too hard to cheer. In turn, Alex, Lydia, Schneider, and Dr. Berkowitz also join in and surround Elena with love for the perfect ending to the episode and the season. Quinces rings comedy from the anxiety of party planning, from the idiosyncrasies of flaky relatives, and from Rita Moreno's commitment to fabulosity. Then it rings drama from Victor's bad parenting and catharsis from Penelope's perfect instinct to save her daughter's night. It's emotional and sweet and doesn't strike any wrong notes, and I hope you'll agree and induct it into the canon. Kevin picked it, so let's start with Kevin.
I think it's probably actually not my favorite One Day at a Time episode, and I'm a little mad at the person who submitted not yet for season two, because I think there's far better episodes in season two. But I think Quinces is absolutely the high point of season one. It is one of the it's a peek on one of the greatest teen queer coming out stories I can remember on television. What you said about it being realistic is totally right. I love that it's warm without being fake. I always think about Glee as kind of the, the antithesis of this, that straight characters were literally breaking out into song to sing about how much they loved Kurt in that show. And, and while I get a little bit of wish fulfillment, I found it really insulting a lot of the time. I have never felt insulted by One Day at a Time. I have never felt condescended to by One Day at a Time. I think it's just so perfectly pitched, and I love this episode, and I am with you. I cry a lot at it. And and if I weren't a yes on it already, the dance would put me there. So yes.
All right, Sarah.
I had seen this episode before, I think when I was prepping for the last main discussion of this
about season two.
So I had seen this before. I am generally I wouldn't say I'm not a fan of the show, but when people are enthusing about it, I'm I get it, but I don't get it. With that said, I cried the first time I saw it. I cried the second time I saw it prepping for this episode. I almost started crying when you mentioned Schneider at the door of the ballroom, which is the moment at which that is a fucking Emmy in 2 seconds of screen time that he's nope. And that character is can be a little bit two dimensional, but man, all the work that they have done, throughout the season to that point, is perfectly paid off in this episode, which is, this kind of live studio audience, oh yeah, this is not my shit. Right. But this is the apotheosis of that. It's cheesy, but it's such delicious, expert, perfectly aged cheese. All the gags are so carefully set up and pay off so beautifully. The series of structured reveals of the dress / tuxedo and the way it ties into the running gag about Lydia and Tobolowsky being in her little sewing area by the and it's her being if you can suture, you can sew. And he helped her to revamp it in time. And that was really cute. Seeing not only the mom being super stressed out about the seating chart, but knowing that my wife Tara would relate very strongly to that part of it was great. Generally speaking, this is a show that I wish I loved as much as people I respect love it, and I don't. But this episode is, this episode is my window into why people love it. And it's really great. And your point is really well taken about Victor's response, which is not cartoonish in either direction. There's not that schmaltzy, heartwarming, I've come around, but there's also not this super villainous thing at the other end of the spectrum. And the famous feminist table gag is the way they use that is, with the exception of her own, pretty funny. So
right, but Rosa Parks should not be in the back waking up from a nightmare.
It's good shit.
Yeah.
Dave.
In regards to the audience reaction stuff, which I agree is usually sort of kryptonite for me when that kind of thing happens, I think that it kind of works in this show because I feel like it's an extension of the show's culture. If the show was, if you had that same scene in the original Waspy One Day at a Time and everybody's yelling, it would feel out of place. But these events, Quinces and stuff, they're very, very loud and very interactive and everybody's, having a party. Right. So sure. I feel like in that context, it works really well. It augments rather than sort of takes me away from the moment. And speaking about augmenting the moment, man, every time we watch this, Tara's waterworks are going on. So
I'm a man. this.
I'm just saying it's a very effective episode. I think Kevin's right. This is the best episode of this season. I think they upped their game in the second season. And, you know, the show started strong and just got stronger. And for this to be the season one capper, just it's emblematic of a good show just getting better and better. So I agree for the five reasons Tara said. And you want to give those five reasons again?
Yes. Those reasons are, once again, as the doc loads, it's extremely specific about the stresses of throwing a quinceañera. The B plot about Elena's dress is a winner on multiple levels. It really celebrates a character who deserves it. It portrays how a coming out can go badly, and it proves Elena does not need Victor.
Yeah, I think you covered it all. And it's just a really strong show, well acted, and it can keep surprising you, which I love about a sitcom. It's hard to do that. So I'm going to vote yes, too. So let's make this official. Kevin O'Keefe, what say you?
Hell yes.
Sarah DiBattic.
C.
And I will also say yes. So that means... One Day at a Time, Season 1, Episode 13, Quinces. You are hereby...
Quinces.
Quinces. How do you say it?
The Anglo...
Quinces. Quinces.
Yeah. You're going to take the extra hot, great cannon. Look, I am who I am, and I can't change. Guys.
I know.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
And now it's time for winner and loser of the week. Who is our winner?
Oh, boy. I have the winner, and it is Ian Ziering.
Yay.
Is that right? Who gets to play Blue Devil on DC's Swamp Thing?
Well, okay.
Speaking of Swamp Things, Tara.
DC has its own streaming service. Swamp Thing is a show that's coming. Ian Ziering is playing a villain.
Okay.
Moving on to the losers. It's too fucking depressing to talk about CBS on our Christmas episode, though I could, over its just revealed handling of a harassment claim that Eliza Dushku made against Michael Weatherly from their time together on Bull. Look it up. Also, many NCIS actresses who worked with Michael Weatherly on that show showing their ass by taking his side and saying he was great to them, and the CBS investigations team, which found cause to terminate Moonves per a PR blast that we received as we're recording this yesterday, and that means they're not paying out the settlement he thought he was getting, which he's suing them over now. So, yeah, but also concluded that harassment and retaliation are not pervasive at CBS, despite multiple shows evidence to the contrary. Like, how many are there at this point? Like 60 Minutes, Bull, NCIS, I think all the NCISs, on and on. Anyway. It's also not Penny Marshall, although we just learned as we recorded this, has passed away of complications from diabetes. Rest in peace, Penny. I guess all of us are losers for your loss. But to keep it marginally light, finally, loser of the week is Alfonso Ribeiro, because he is suing the makers of Fortnite for stealing the Carlton dance for the game.
Wait, how does it make him a loser, though?
Why wouldn't you be happy that Fortnite is celebrating you?
Because, yeah. Okay, all right. So here's the deal. Fortnite makes a zillion dollars a minute. It makes like millions of dollars a day just on their like cell phone version, just from people buying shit like the Carlton dance. Like they have to buy it like for a dollar or something like that. So
yeah,
they're getting paid for it. Dance moves and stuff like that is copyrightable.
Not by him. That's not a character he owns.
Right. No, it's not his.
He's going to lose. Loser.
Yeah. He doesn't own that.
We don't know that. Like, he's a choreographer. Like it might be prior art situation where he used it before the show, but whatever.
All right,
I guess I'm going to guess that his contract with whoever produced that show is good enough that show owns it. But somebody is going to get money out of Epic Games on this. If it's not him, it's going to be that production company now that has been opened. I say.
All right. Fair enough.
Speaking of fair enough, you know what time it is?
Not time to do the Carlton dance where anyone can see
you. No, don't do it. Also, Fortnite's a terrible game, so there's that. Anyways.
I was waiting for that.
Jeez, way to bury the lead.
This is the fifth game time of the season. The season scores are, get this, Value guess 3. Sarah 1. Ooh. Tara nothing.
Ooh.
Today we are playing On the Map, Off the Map from Sean Pfluger from Pflugerville, just north of Austin, who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot, great extra credit topic of his choosing. Yes, that's the right one.
What if he is from Pflugerville? What if he's descended from the Pflugers who founded Pflugerville?
That would be fantastic. In On the Map, Off the Map, we'll take the cast of an ensemble show such as Roseanne, and then we'll give you the name of a TV show that one of the cast of Roseanne starred after Roseanne. Okay. For example, the show is The Talk. The actor would be?
Sarah Gilbert.
Right. And then we're going to make it harder, and we're going to go to a show before Roseanne. For example, Fernwood Night from 1977, starring Fred Willard. Garth Gimble, frequent Roseanne guest star, and Jerry Hubbard are the hosts of a talk show produced in the fictitious town of Fernwood, Ohio. The show featured parodies of guests that might appear on real talk shows, only with a twisted small-town mentality of Fernwood. Who is the Roseanne person that starred in that?
Martin Mull.
Now, you're correct, and that's how we're going to play. There's some tricky stuff about the order of play, but we're going to tackle that once it starts. Tara, okay. Steel meal situation.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting is still our steel meal leader with 5. Valued guests have 2, and I have 1. So, Kevin, steel meal is if one of the other players answers wrong, you can leap in and say steel meal and steal their points and answer the question once they've already given a wrong answer and before, obviously, Dave gives the right one.
Got it.
Okay, so let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first in On the Map, Off the Map. On the Map, Off the Map. There we go.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. That means Kevin is going first, followed by Sarah, then Tara. Are we ready to play On the Map, Off the Map?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to give you 3 shows, Kevin. You're going to pick which one you want to play, and you're playing the whole show. I'm going to give you 6 afters, 6 befores, and see how many of those you can get. So, round 1, the shows are, you choose, Beverly Hills 90210. Ah! You may have to play strategically.
Yeah, I know.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Friends. Which one of those shows do you want to do?
Oh,
Beverly,
God.
Buffy, Friends.
I almost just want to steal 90210 because I know that I'm leaving a big weapon in y'all's hands otherwise. But I don't know the show very well.
You're too young.
I'm too young for all of these shows. Friends is the one that's closest in my age range, so I say Friends.
Okay, so Friends. First, we're going to start it easy with the after shows, all right? So okay. I will read the name of the show. You just have to tell me the Friends actor. And it's not necessarily always somebody that's in the leading credit. Sometimes
it's
reoccurring guests or stuff like that. So with that in mind, here we go. The show they start in after is called The Comeback.
Oh, Lisa Kudrow.
The Odd Couple.
For 1 point, right?
Yeah.
Matthew Perry.
The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story.
Ross Geller. David Schwimmer.
Web Therapy.
Lisa Kudrow.
Feed the Beast.
I don't even know what that show is. I'll take a random guess. Courtney Cox.
That was David Schwimmer in Feed the Beast. And your last after show, Dirt.
Oh, Courtney Cox.
That's Courtney Cox. All right, 5 out of 6. Well done.
Nice.
Now, it's going to get a little trickier. We're talking before shows, all right?
Okay.
All right. The before show was Mad About You from 1992, starring Paul Reiser. And if you want, I can give you a little more information. How about I just do that?
Yeah, maybe. Considering I was born in 1991, I think that would be,
All right.
In Mad About You,
Jesus.
When you were just 1, shit in your pants, this Friends actor was a frequent guest star as a waitress.
Okay, so it's a woman. I guess
if you do your Friends history, this would be an easy one.
I don't, unfortunately. I'm surprised I did as well as I did in round 1, mostly because I'm gay and I like Lisa Kudrow. Jennifer Aniston.
Mm. should have kept with Lisa Kudrow. That was Lisa Kudrow playing Phoebe's sister on Mad About You. Sula. All right. The before is The Misfits of Science from 1985. Misfits of Science, which is a superhero series about a group of young mutants who worked for an American think tank fighting crime. All right, fighting crime. And the Friends actor had telekinetic powers. This character's name was Gloria.
Oh, so it was... Okay, all right. Courtney Cox?
Correct.
Yeah.
Top of the Heap, 1991. This starred Joey Lauren Adams, a spinoff with the characters from Married with Children. Intellectually challenged Vinny was the Friends actor in this show.
It's the guy who plays Joey. What is his last name? Matthew something. I literally can't remember the guy. Can I get credit for knowing it's Joey?
Well, actually, the actor's name isn't really important as much as you can identify them, but I'm a little worried that you said Matthew, because I'm not sure who you actually mean, but you did say the actor who played Joey, so I'm going to give it to you because I'm feeling generous. That's Matt LeBlanc.
Matt LeBlanc, that's what it is. All right, yeah.
He goes by
yeah.
Matt, for future reference.
But there is Matthew Perry.
You young
yes,
child.
Okay, fair.
Sydney is the show from 1990. Sydney was a sitcom about a woman named Sydney, played by Valerie Bertinelli, who moves her New York detective agency to her hometown with her younger brother, played by this Friends actor. He played a rookie cop tagging along.
I'll guess David Schwimmer on that one.
That was Matthew Perry.
Oh, I would not have guessed that.
1990, the show Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller.
There was a Ferris Bueller show?
Yep.
Briefly.
Oh.
This Friends actor plays Ferris's sister. So the... Jennifer Grey, is that who played?
Yep.
Yeah. That I would have to assume is Courtney Cox.
Jennifer Grey to Jennifer Aniston.
Oh, that's shocking. Okay. All right.
Finally, the before show is Monty from 1994, starring Henry Winkler,
the Bonds.
Monty Richardson is a conservative talk show host a la Rush Limbaugh. You know who Rush Limbaugh is, Kevin?
Yes.
he still exists in this timeline.
Unfortunately.
Monty's family is very liberal, however, including his son, this Friends actor.
Matthew Perry?
That was David Schwimmer. All right, that is yours. How many points did he get, Tara?
7.
All right, 7. Sarah, you have 90210 or Buffy?
Oh, boy. I mean,
both shows you are familiar with.
Yeah. And one of them, my wife is much more familiar with than the other one. So do I screw her over or do I just go with Buffy?
Play to win. Play to win.
What should I do? It's, you know, the week before Christmas, so I'm going to take Buffy.
Wow.
What?
All right.
Shocked.
See how that plays out.
I would have been fucked with Buffy.
Here are your after shows. You name the actor. The Crazy Ones.
Oh, please, no.
We watched this one.
Oh, yeah. Why'd you do that? That's Sarah Michelle Gellar.
How I Met Your Mother.
Why am I blanking on her? It's Willow.
Uh-huh. I know you know the actor's name, so we're going to give this a couple
the
more seconds.
Hair.
Allison Hannigan.
Thank you.
She knew that actress.
I gave Kevin that point. So I guess I got to give you that point. But I'm going to be a little straight. Y'all got one freebie, all right? That's all I'm giving
you. Okay. Fair
enough. Kitchen Confidential.
Kitchen Confidential?
Yes.
Oh, God. Who would have been in Kitchen Confidential? Could I hear a little more about Kitchen Confidential?
Nope.
No?
That's only for the before shows.
Bradley Cooper was the star. Michael Vartan guest starred in one episode as a French guy speaking French.
Oh, wow.
I watched it.
Yeah, and I could see why.
All right, we're going to call it. Name an actor.
Anthony Stewart Head. Why not?
That's Nicholas Brendon. Brendon. All right, guy. Here's a tough one. Bones.
bones. Noted chicken fearer, David Boreanaz.
God, I forgot about that.
It's so good.
Ringer.
Ringer. Shit. Ringer?
Yeah. No question mark in the actual title, but yes.
I think you watched at least one of those. It was the same season as Revenge.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I know who was in Ringer, so let's say Geller again.
Good guess.
I was so ready to steal that.
Gossip Girl.
Gossip Girl? Buzz? It's Anthony Stewart Head. I don't actually know. I never watched that.
That's Dawn, Michelle Trachtenberg.
Oh, right. Trachtenberg. Oh, yeah.
All right.
It's Vanessa.
Well, you kind of struggle with those, so let's see how the befores go. VR5, 1995, starring Laurie Singer. I remember the show. Sydney is a telephone line worker and computer hobbyist. One day, she actually discovers something and blah, blah, blah. She's got access to virtual reality, where she interacts with other people. She receives her covert assignments from Oliver Sampson, this Buffy actor.
Is this Brendan again?
No, this is Anthony Stewart.
This is Anthony Stewart
playing VR Giles, apparently. Malibu Shores, 1995, with starring Carrie Russell.
Oh my God, that's right.
When students from upper crust Malibu mix with ones from working class San Fernando Valley, they discover that certain issues can cut across class boundaries. Starring this Buffy actress.
Is this Dushku?
Rizma Carpenter.
Oh, yeah.
The Birds of Paradise, BYRDS. Starring Timothy Busfield, Sam Bird, guess how that's spelled. A teacher and his family take up residence in Hawaii after his wife dies. Harry, Buffy actor, Zeke and Franny each have their own problems accepting the new arrangement.
I'm going to go Seth Green on this one.
You're going to go correct.
Busfield.
Free Spirit, 89. Whitney was a cute blonde housekeeper to the Harper family. She was also a witch and often resorted to magic to get the Harper kids, including Buffy actor, out and into trouble. So Winnie has to deal with this Buffy actor as one of the kids.
Oh, Corinne Borer. Now I get
Corinne
it.
Borer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Veronica Mars's mom.
Yes.
Is this Nicholas Brendan again?
This is Allison Hannigan.
Oh.
All right. Girl Talk, 1989, starring Soleil Moon Frye. Short-lived TV show that was televised version of teen magazines. Three regular hostesses who talked about girl issues such as boys, clothes, and boys. One of the hosts was...
Geller?
Oh, really? Wow! I would have thought she was on soaps by then.
All right, last one. Swan's Crossing, 92, starring Brittany Daniel. Swan's Crossing was a short-lived half-hour serial following the lives, loves, and intrigues of 12 wealthy teenagers, including Sydney, played by this Buffy actor.
Too many Sydneys.
Sydneys.
Yeah, Jesus.
The 90s.
Yeah. Gosh. This Buffy. Sydney.
Swan's Crossing.
I think this is, I don't know, Boreanaz.
That Geller, is, right? Again, Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh, yeah.
All right. How many points did Sarah get with the Buffy round?
Six.
You're all
welcome.
Right. Tara, that means you have Beverly Hills 90210.
Okay.
Here we go. The after show.
I believe I've heard of it.
The dollar sign treat, otherwise known as the street.
Oh, my God. Who amongst them? Oh, God, I can picture all their stupid faces.
Gonna need an answer.
Lindsay Price.
Nope, sorry, wrong button.
Oh.
Jenny Garth.
Really?
Jenny Garth.
Okay.
Sorry to toy with your emotions.
Thank you.
Could have been Lindsay Price.
The TV show. Murder in the First.
Oh, my God. Oh, Kathleen Robertson. I was thinking of the first murder in the first. Yes?
Windfall.
This is Luke Perry.
The TV show. Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Ryan Austin Green.
The TV show, the U.S. version of Coupling.
Oh, no. Who? Is this Lindsay Price? Ah!
All right, your last after show, Fastlane. Fastlane.
Oh, Tiffany Amber Thiessen.
Correct. And there's another car show that year, too, I remember.
I think you
smoked that. Jeez.
That was 5 out of 6.
That got the same as you did.
Here are your before shows.
I guess that's true.
Before round. Yes.
Little House on the Prairie. She started in 1992.
Shannon Doherty.
This Bev Niner played the adoptive daughter of Laura, correct? In season 9 and a bunch of TV movies after that. Knott's Landing, 1986.
Oh, God.
Wait, I give you more information.
Okay.
This 90210 actor is the second actor to play the son of Olivia Cunningham and was used as a mule to transport drugs and money to and from her dealer.
Is this Ian Ziering?
This is not Ryan Austin Green.
Oh.
Okay, this is a hard one. Saved by the Bell.
Sorry, Kevin. You got to be faster. Sorry, Kevin. Go ahead.
I did. Saved by the Bell.
Yep. Oh.
I'm just going to stop there. Do you want me to read more? Because I can.
No. Tori Spelling.
Saved by the Bell?
Oh, Tiffany. Right.
Wow.
She was in a couple of episodes, but yeah, okay, no, it's Tiffany Amber Thiessen.
Obviously not who we were looking for. Our House, 1986, starring Wilford Brimley.
I think this is Shannon Doherty again.
Correct. Teen Angel, 89.
Jason Priestley?
Let me know if you just want more hints, because I'm going to do it that way. And finally, okay, Sister Kate, 89 as well.
This was Jason Priestley and Luke Perry, I think.
You are correct. Jason Priestley was the star of Sister Kate. All right, Tara, how many did you get there, and what are our scores?
Niner. I have 9. Kevin has 7. Sarah has 6. Close game.
All right. Ooh. So it is round 2. Who's in last place?
Sarah.
All right, Sarah, I'm going to give you first choice. This is round 2 of 2. Arrested Development, West Wing, or The Office?
Ooh.
Oh. West Wing.
West Wing. All right, here we go. Your after shows. Name the actor. Grace and Frankie.
Sheen. Martin Sheen.
Counterpart?
Oh, Counterpart. Jesus. Who's in that? Jesus, I don't know.
Richard Schiff.
Oh, of course. Shit.
The show The Grinder.
Rob Lowe?
Ding.
Scandal.
Scandal. What's
his name? You know, that guy.
Yeah,
sure. David Rosen. His little glasses. We were on his podcast.
We were on his podcast.
His name, Josh Flugen. I don't know why I can't remember his name. Oh, God.
Can I steal?
Yep.
Josh Molina.
Thank you.
All right. You got 2 left in your after bits. Out of Practice.
Out of Practice.
Out of
Practice. Sounds like a great show. Can you tell me any more about it?
Mm-mm.
No?
No.
Only for the befores.
Oh, right. Only for the befores. Out of Practice. Oh.
All right. Gonna need an answer.
Is this Rob Lowe again? I don't think it is. But...
Can I steal?
Does he have more left?
This is your last steal, but go ahead.
Okay.
Stalker Janney.
Correct. Well done. That's how you use those steel mills, people. Nice. All right. Here's your last after show. Mr. Sunshine. Yes.
Also featuring a Friends after.
Oh, yeah. That's who I was thinking of. But
And then I was like, oh, he was on it, but he wasn't. That was Studio 60. Ugh.
Though actually, he was on
West Wing. He was on both. It was Matthew Perry, but that's not the West Wing person.
Right, but that's not who you're thinking of. And there's just a gray void where this person should be.
All right. Just want to name a West Wing actor here because I'm about to buzz you.
My mind is empty of all. John Spencer.
No.
I don't know.
That's Allison Janney. Allison Janney.
It would be kind of hard for John Spencer to do any shows after the West Wing.
Hard, but not impossible.
Not
have the technology. All right. Here are your befores. West Wing. Just Friends, 1979. This series revolves around health spa assistant manager Susan Hughes, portrayed by this West Wing actor whose marriage is falling apart.
Is this also Stalker Channing?
Ding.
Murder One, 1995. High-powered attorneys defend an arrogant young actor with a track record of drug and alcohol problems. This West Wing actor plays a lawyer fired and rehired by firm head Theo Hoffman.
Yeah, that show was so famous, and then no one ever talks about it anymore. Is this one Bradley Whitford?
This is Mary McCormick. Mary McCormick.
Oh, yeah.
A New Kind of Family, 1979, starring Aline Brennan. She stars as Kit Flanagan, a widowed mother of three, including this West Wing actor.
Oh, boy. A divorced woman in order to save money.
Well, that's the lead. The West Wing actor.
It's one of the kids.
Yeah, got it. All right. I think this is Whitford.
This is Rob Lowe. Rob Lowe.
Oh, wow.
All right. Secret Lives of Men from 1998, starring Peter Gallagher. With nothing left but each other, Michael, Phil, played by this West Wing actor, and Andy form an exclusive club and embark on a new phase of their existence.
Bradley Whitford?
One day is going to be right, and that day is today.
Yay!
Finally, Jesus.
All right, Relativity, 1996, starring Kimberly Williams. Romantic and family serial drama comedy.
Yep.
Series about two American strangers in their 20s who meet and fall in love in Italy, return home, get to know each other's family, and take on new challenges in their lives.
Ooh. Oh, I watched this too. And I mean, this might be wrong, but I just feel like this is Schiff again.
I think you're right.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sarity Bunting, this is your last before West Wing. The show To Have and To Hold from 1998. All right. To Have and To Hold, 98. The drama series followed Annie Cornell, an attorney, and her husband, an Irish-American police officer, Sean. The series depicted the trials and tribulations of their early married life.
A couple of choices here.
What do you think?
I'm going to go with Janelle Maloney.
What was your other thought?
Elizabeth Moss. And then I was like, but she would have been like 15.
In her teens, yeah.
You're forgetting about season one, Moira Kelly.
Yeah. Oh.
Moira Kelly. Andy.
Everyone's all right. Fave.
How many did she get there, Tara?
Her score is now 11.
All right. Kevin and Tara were tied, or Kevin had a little less, right?
We were tied, but Kevin just stole. So, I mean, we weren't. We are now, but going into the round.
All right, Kevin, you choose next. Arrested Development or The Office?
Arrested Development.
All right, Arrested Development, after shows. Welcome to the Captain.
I have no idea.
Well, do you want to name an actor?
No.
At random? Jeffrey Tambor. Jeffrey Tambor.
Yeah.
Your second show, Flaked.
I do know this. It was that awful Netflix show. Will Arnett.
Yep.
All right. Two possible answers for your next show, Running Wild with an E.
Oh, I vaguely remember this.
You got two options.
I have two options.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I know neither one of them. David Cross.
That's one of them. The other one, Will Arnett. Will Arnett.
Oh.
No, the other one, Jason Bateman, wasn't it?
No, it's Will Arnett.
Oh, you're right. You're right. You're right. You're right.
The show Archer.
Jessica Walter.
Yeah.
The show Better Off Ted.
Portia de Rossi.
And finally, for your afters, Andy Barker, PI.
Andy. shit. Conan's right hand, Andy Richter.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, he's not a regular. That's not the answer.
I didn't think it always had to be regulars. I thought that was.
He's not regular enough, is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
I'm giving you additional information. It's not just guest stars. It's not guest stars. It's actual. Substantial.
He was on a few episodes.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm telling you, it's not the answer. Unless you want to keep there, you want to roll the dice and go with Andy Richter.
I'm thinking it's not at this point, but I don't know who it is at that point. I'll just guess. David Cross, whatever.
No, that's Tony Hale. Tony Hale.
Oh, okay.
That was his assistant dude. All right, your befores. The Jake Effect, 2004, starring Greg Grunberg. The resident development actor is Jake Galvin, a well-played lawyer, disillusioned by the unethical cases he defends. Changing careers, he becomes a teacher at a Chicago area high school.
Sounds awful.
Jason Bateman.
Okay, this is a tough one. Mr. Show with Bob and David, also starring Bob Odenkirk.
David Cross.
New York Daze, D-A-Z-E, 1995, starring Eric Schaefer. Eric, a writer that hardly ever writes, and Donnie, photographer that refuses to show his work in public, struggle with things like daily jobs and promotions that will ultimately interrupt their dreams of being a writer and a photographer.
Or when Eric Schaefer was going to be something?
Yeah, I was just thinking that. What's the character's name? Manny?
Donnie.
Donnie, sorry. I don't know where Manny came from. Will Arnett.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. That was Portia de Rossi.
Oh!
Yeah.
Cruel.
All right. Here's a good one from the family TV history vaults. Valerie's family, : the Hogans. I don't remember that pre-colon title. I thought it was just called the Hogans. Famously starring Sandy Duncan. Valerie Hogan is what you call a super mom. Valerie's husband, Michael, is an airline pilot. So the job of raising their three boys is mostly left to Valerie, except she's dead. There's Girl Hungry David, played by this Arrested Development actor. One of the sons.
This is Bateman, right?
This is Bateman.
Yeah.
And right. I think Dylan's
father
dad
was
the,
Jack McKay.
Was the pilot. Yep.
It was pretty foxy in that uniform, too.
Yep.
But watched a lot while babysitting. Fuck off.
Speaking about dubious pieces of TV history, Dinosaurs, 1995, starring Sally Struthers. Dinosaurs follow the life of a family of dinosaurs living in a modern world. They have TV, fridges, and all that stuff. Arrested Development actor is the mother of the family.
I mean, I have no idea, but I'll guess Jessica Walter.
You are correct. All right, and finally, this one's another tough one. Before, Ally McBeal, starring Calissa Flockhart. Do you want to take a stab at that, or do you need the...
No, I actually need character, yeah.
Okay. Ally McBeal and Billy Thomas were going steady through their childhoods. Ally even followed Billy to Harvard Law School, despite having no interest in the law. When Billy chose to... This is nothing about the character that she plays. That's a terrible clue.
She doesn't
One
come
moment.
In until later.
Anybody want to throw in a clue for him?
She played Nell, N-E-L-L-E.
There you go.
Not going to help. But I'll guess Portia de Rossi.
Guess what? You're right.
Yay!
All right. How many points did he get there, and what's his total score?
He got 9 for a total score of 18.
All right. And how many do you have at the moment?
9.
All right. So you need more than 9.
Almost run the table.
Here you go. Your show, The Office.
Yep.
Your after shows. Name the actor. Mm-hmm. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh, boy. who the hell is on that show who's not Kimmy or Titus or what's her face?
Actor from The Office.
Couldn't yeah. even answer.
I'm going to call this just so I can hear what happens when I tell you it's Ellie Kemper.
God damn it. I forgot she was on that show. Okay.
Wow.
Yep.
All right. I know.
Yep. Stupid.
You could collectively stupid. Hear everybody screaming.
I know. I'm like, Creed? I had nothing.
The show. Okay. You, Me, and the Apocalypse.
Jenna Fisher.
The show. The Blacklist.
James Spader. Duh.
The show. People of Earth.
Shit. God, there's so many people on that show.
You're watching the show in her head.
I am. I don't know. Brian Husky? I don't know.
Oscar Nunez.
Right.
Played the priest.
Yep.
Silicon Valley.
Oh, Zach Woods.
And our last after show, Backstrom.
Rainn Wilson.
Backstrom with Rainn Wilson. All right. Here are your befores.
Okay, I got to get 5 out of these 6 to tie Kevin.
The Dana Carvey Show, 1996, starring Dana Carvey. Mm-hmm. Hired as a writer, he played various characters on the sketch comedy show in 8 episodes.
Steve Carell.
The Daily Show, 2002, with Jon Stewart. A frequent correspondent.
I'm going to assume it's not Steve Carell again and say Ed Helms.
Yes. 6 Feet Under, 2001, starring Peter Krause. This Office actor plays a young intern from mortuary school who works in the Fisher Family Funeral Home. That's fun to say. Oh. Fisher Family Funeral Home.
No, I don't remember. Intern. BJ Novak?
Oh, you're going to kick yourself. That's Rainn Wilson.
Shit.
Remember oh,
right,
Arthur?
Yeah. Right. Oh, Arthur.
All right. That means you got to get all of these to tie. And they're not easy.
Great.
Your show.
Hit me.
Lucky, 2003, starring John Corbett.
Oh, no.
In this dark comedy television series. Do you remember this? I vaguely have a memory of this. Dark comedy television series, which ran for a total of 1 seasons on FX.
Mm-hmm.
John Corbett stars as Michael Lucky Linkletter, a professional poker player and gambling addict who hangs around other small-time gamblers on the Las Vegas Strip, including his friend Buddy, played by this Office reoccurring character actor. So there's a hint there.
Buddy. Is it the guy who played... Roy?
Well, I am going to give you one of those. And your answer is Roy? By whoever Roy plays?
Yeah.
Very close, but not correct.
Shit.
Also worked in the back office.
Oh, Craig Robinson?
Craig Robinson, correct. Shit. All right, let's play this out. Okay. Dirty Dancing 88, starring the actual actress. Television series followed the same premise as the movie with a few variations. Mm-hmm. Series was set at Kellerman's during the summer of 63, but instead of being the daughter of a resort guest, Baby is now the daughter of the resort owner.
Okay. And it's Baby?
Yeah, Baby.
Okay, Jenna Fisher?
Well, how young should we be in 88?
I don't know.
All right, this is kind of a tough one. She played Jan in The Office. That's Melora Hardin.
Melora Walters.
Hardin.
Duh. Yeah.
All right, last one. I think you'll get this one.
Okay.
The show Wire, 2003, starring Dominic West. This late entry Office actor played a big part in this series' 2nd season and popped in occasionally in the next 3. So not Idris Elba.
Okay. Is it Chris Bauer?
Amy Ryan popped in as Dee Dee in season 2.
All right, let's
get the final scores, please, Tara.
Okay. Well, Sarah finished with 11. I had 16. And valued guests dominating again. Kevin wins with 18 points.
And we all underestimated him because he was born 3 years ago. But now look who's winning. It's Kevin.
Valued guests. valued
Kevin!
Guest.
Kevin.
Congratulations, Kevin. Well done, man.
That's the only reason I won, yeah.
Good job.
Well, that's it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. If you're thinking this is the second or third take of the outro, you're incorrect. We decked our halls with holiday editions of Nailed It and RuPaul's Drag Race before traveling around the dial in Santa's sleigh with stops at Dr. Pimple Popper, Runaways, Teen Mom, and Little Drummer Girl. Some reality shows were gifted spinoffs, and Tara gave us the gift of her successful canon submission for One Day at a Time's Season 1 finale. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Kevin, playing for valued guests, was the winner of this week's Game Time, putting them within one win of a season victory.
Holy shit.
Remember.
We're listening.
Ah! I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I forgot that I was first. Holidays, mulled wine.
Boo, Sarah D. Bunting.
Shalom, listeners.
And Kevin O'Keefe.
I'm going to go spend my evening with Nicole and Jacques.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grade.
Wow, that was so fun!
Let's do it again!
Shut up, Michelle!
God almighty.